All right, I guess we can start in chapter 14 of Matthew tonight. Chapter 14. This is, again, outlines are pretty subjective. This is how I've divided this up. First 12 verses have to do with the story of John the Baptist's death. We'll talk about that more when we get there. And then you have the feeding of the 5,000 and walking on water and a lot of things associated with that. And then the chapter ends with a number of healings that Jesus did. A lot of good material in these sections. And one of them, and I started to just use the whole time tonight looking at the Herods. Herod and John, this is Herod Antipas. To me, this story of the Herods is interesting. And it's really difficult to not know who these Herods were, the various ones, in the Gospels and in Acts, because they play a very pivotal role in those books. And it's not the easiest study in the world, because the sons of Herod the Great went by different names. They may have had two or three names, and the writer doesn't always identify which Herod is being talked about. But as we'll see, and I will deal with some of this, because maybe it'll kind of whet your appetite to look at some of this stuff, because it's really crucial that we understand the kind of men that the Herods were. And so first several verses of chapter, well, let's go back, because Matthew says in chapter 14, verse 1, at that time. So obviously that's a reference to something that's just been said. At the end of chapter 13, Matthew says when he was come into his own country, that's Jesus, he taught them in their synagogue, insomuch that they were astonished and said, whence hath this man this wisdom and these mighty works? That pretty well sums up the work of Jesus. As he taught various groups or individuals, they could not miss the fact that Jesus spoke with an authority that nobody else had. Remember, we got to the end of the Sermon on the Mount in chapter 7. Matthew observed that this is what astonished the crowds that he spoke to on that occasion. This is what impressed them the most, the authority by which he spoke. Nobody, their rabbis, nobody that they were acquainted with ever spoke that way. And so that was something different about Jesus. And the other thing different about him was the miracles that he did. Nobody did the kind of signs and wonders and miracles that Jesus did. And so here were two very important, very outstanding reasons for believing that Jesus was God. We don't know exactly what it was in Jesus' teaching that impressed his hearers with his wisdom. I have all ideas. This is I'm just guessing now. It could have been that as Jesus, of course, the only scriptures that they had back then were the Old Testament. And so it could have been that as Jesus expounded upon various Old Testament books and so forth, that he gave explanations that they had never heard. They had probably never met a man with the wide variety of knowledge that Jesus had. And again, I'm just supposing here. And the way he was able to connect passages in the Old Testament with other, he could harmonize passages in the Old Testament. And then again, I have all ideas that as he expounded upon the Old Testament, that he made some very obvious connections between what the prophets had foretold up to 1,000 years before when David wrote, and David was a prophet, that he connected himself, in fact, we know that he did on some occasions, he connected himself to those prophecies and claimed that those prophecies were fulfilled in him. I don't know that any other rabbi, anybody else that taught these Jews had ever done something that outrageous. At least they thought it was outrageous. And then to back up what he said, that he was the Messiah, he's the one that that these prophets were talking about, and the miracles that he did, the conclusion had to have been, this man is the Son of God. He's deity. I watch a lot of YouTube videos, and a lot of them from religious people, and one of the arguments that they make is that nowhere did Jesus ever make the claim to being God. He's wrong about that. But Jesus didn't have to come right out and say, I am deity. Anybody with a brain that could put two and two together and get four could listen to Jesus and draw that conclusion. There was no other conclusion you could draw except that. And so whether you're talking about modernistic people or even some of our brethren who teach that when Jesus was upon earth, he did not claim to be, he wasn't deity. It's just as wrong as it can be. I don't know why brethren who ought to know better would make a claim like that. But anyway, so at that time, at the time of Jesus' preaching, and the wisdom that they heard and the mighty works, the miracles that he did, at that time, Herod the Tetrarch heard the news about Jesus and said to his servants, this is John the Baptist. He has risen from the dead, and that is why miraculous powers are at work in him. Now, why it was, and we're not told this, Matthew doesn't tell us, why was it that Herod concluded that this miracle worker, this man who taught such powerful things, why would it be that Herod would conclude that John the Baptist had come back to life? Anybody have, a speculation as to why? Maybe he did that. The Herods were very, very superstitious people, among other things that they were. And which Herod was it that had John's head cut off? Huh? It's this guy right here. Yeah. That's right. Do you think maybe guilty conscience, if the Herods ever had a conscience, do you think that maybe he was scared? This guy's come back from the grave to haunt, haunt me. Could have been. We don't know. Like I say, we don't know. It's interesting, though, when you get into the study of the Herods, they had so many psychological problems and everything that there's no telling what his thinking process was. So anyway, at that time, Herod the Tetrarch heard the news about Jesus and said to his servants, "This is John the Baptist. He has risen from the dead, and that is why miraculous powers are at work in him." So a lot of superstition here, a lot of fear. I'm being speculative because if you study the Herods, you begin to understand why they do or don't do a lot of things. They were scared people, and the lifestyle they led would lead a person. They were Idumeans. They were associated with the Edomites. And so they had a small amount of information about Jesus and the Jewish religion and so forth. So anyway, those are all things that, but the other thing I want to talk about is here in verse 1, there are about, what, 5 or 6 references to the Herods. I don't think that any of this is accidental. I think that Matthew included their names here because the Jews of that day would have been very aware. They knew who the Herods were. Absolutely, they knew. And were probably scared of them for good reason. So anyway, verses 1 through 5, Herod was scared of John from the things that Matthew records here. And then in verses 6 through 11, the party for Herod's birthday and the rash vow that he made for his, it would have been his stepdaughter. It was something that had him a little bit on the spooky side. And then verse 12 talks about John's disciples. Okay, let's begin to look a little bit further. That family tree, I have been working for a long time to come up with a family tree of the Herods. And if you want something that will consume several years of your time, try to make a family tree of that bunch. This is a work in progress. Any of you that have done this before, you'll notice that there are some corrections after I put this thing together. There are some corrections that probably need to be made. But anyway, let's just start with Herod the Great. Most of our information comes from Matthew. And then this one passage in Luke talks about Herod the Great. When you learn these things, and I'm sure a lot of you know these things about Herod the Great, when you are aware of these things, you can understand why, genetically, I guess, he passed on a lot of bad genes to his offspring. He was called the procurator of Judea after the murder of Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar was one of the men that was responsible for kind of kicking Herod up the ladder of succession in connection with the Jews. And then Mark Antony, who, the next point, who had been promoted up, Mark Antony was the one who gave him the title King of the Jews. And then Mark Antony and Cleopatra, and that's the Mark Antony and the Cleopatra, they were responsible in large part for Herod's promotion. Herod probably wouldn't have been where he was were it not for Antony and Cleopatra. So what kind of a guy was he? Well, he had 10 wives. He killed two of them. He killed three of his sons. He killed a brother-in-law. And he killed a grandfather of one of his wives. Nice guy. Somebody that you did not want to get on the bad side of. He just as sorry as he could be. Augustus Caesar, who was no saint, obviously, Augustus Caesar said that he would rather be Herod's hog than Herod's son. In other words, Herod would treat his hog better than he would treat his son. That was just his reputation. And then, right before Herod died, he gathered together some of the men that he trusted, and he said, "Now, when I die," now this is from Josephus, the text does not tell us this, but Josephus said, and Josephus is a pretty reliable historian, that right when he knew he was dying, he gathered together a lot of the men that he had some kind of confidence in, and he said, "Now, when I die, I want you to go around and round up as many of the well-known, well-beloved men among the Jews and kill them." Anybody know why he wanted them killed? He knew that nobody was going to cry when he died, but he wanted tears shed. And the best way to do that was to go around and kill a large number of Jewish men, leaders among the Jews, so there would be tears. Now, that the men did not do that when Herod died, to their credit. They didn't round up those guys and have them killed. But this is the kind of guy that... So it's not any wonder that when Herod found out about the birth of somebody, he was paranoid. When he heard about the birth of Jesus, this is why. I mean, this was nothing. Kill a bunch of babies? Big deal. No problem at all. So, anyway, this is the fountainhead of the Herods. And it's about as sorry a family as you'll ever find in the New Testament or the Old Testament. Further, his offspring, and I'm not going to try to go through and give both of the names of these men. I'll just give you the ones that are mostly used. Philip married Herodias and then married his niece. Philip the Tetrarch married this niece, Salome. Herodias was married to two of her uncles. Aristobulus married Salome. Drusilla left her husband to marry Festus, who was the Roman governor. You read that over in the latter part of the book, about 25, 26, chapter in Acts. Antipas killed John the Baptist and married Herodias. Salome was married to her uncle and her cousin. Bernice married her uncle, Calchas, and lived with her brother. And Agrippa II lived with his sister. So you can imagine when Jesus comes and preaches purity, when John comes and does the same thing, they were horribly immoral, but they got the point. In fact, this is what got John killed, of course. But anyway, that's just sort of an overview and a very brief one about the Herod family. They were just, and you know, I look at this and I don't want to get too specific here. You ever watch the news sometime and you think about politicians and you think, golly, I don't know. This is just about as bad as it gets. Really. You look at the lives of some of these characters that make our laws, you know, and whose lives are like an alley cat. They're just as wicked and sorry as they can be. Nothing new about that. The Herods, and you go back even before that to Jezebel, immorality, and we sometimes say gross immorality. I think we need to, all immorality is gross, but we have a tendency to kind of, you know, put shades on immorality. But this kind of gross immorality, and this is just part of it. This is just a part of it. Nothing's changed. And this is what first century Christians had to live under. These were their leaders. That's a quick overview and a very superficial look at the Herod family and the kind of political atmosphere, if you want to call it that, that first century Christians, not only when Christ was upon earth, but when you get into the book of Acts, you know, you're going to read a lot about the Herods, about the sons, the various sons of Herod the Great. And so first century Christians had to stand before people like this. They were just not nice people, which is an understatement. Okay. Any questions there? All right. So that's the kind of family we're looking at here in Matthew chapter 14. The feeding of the 5,000. I skipped over the death of, I'll tell you what. There's one point I want to make about the death of John the Baptizer. What was it that John did that got his head cut off? Remember? Huh? About?
About how he was immoral.
In what way?
By marrying his cousin Philip's wife.
Okay. He was in a marriage that was inappropriate. It was sinful. And evidently, from what the text says, John had been speaking out about Herod's relationship with her over a period of time. We don't know how long. But one of the things that he said to Herod was, you have what? You have no right to her. Now, the reason I bring this up, and this is a sensitive subject, and I'm well aware of that, but I've heard a lot of times, not just religious people outside of the ones that we associate with, but a lot of times it's not unusual to hear religious people, when you talk to them about the subject of divorce comes up, and then you say something about, well, they've got no right to, no, don't tell me that. I can't think of a, I'm saying what they say. That is the closest and most emotional of all human relations, and that's right. Do you mean to tell me that it might be the case where a man and woman are living together as husband and wife, and it might be God's will that they break that relationship off? No, don't tell me that. Jesus loved people. He wanted people to be happy. Then you come to Matthew 14. And that's exactly. Now, how much more detail John got into than is recorded in Matthew 14, we don't know. But he made it pretty clear that Herod and his wife had no business being husband and wife. So don't try to tell me that it sometimes might be God's will that two people sever their relationship, their marriage. I don't know what else to conclude on that than that. There are some things worse than not being married. And one of those things is being in a marriage like Herod had living with his sister-in-law. Being in a marriage relationship with a woman or a man, it violates some scriptural principles about marriage. That's not an easy thing to say, and it's not something that you say lightly. It's a sad, sad thing. And I would be very careful in making that statement to a couple if I didn't feel like I was on pretty solid ground. John evidently felt that he was. And so he told that couple, he told John and his sister-in-law that they had no right. Well, the sister-in-law, John's wife, didn't like it, to put it mildly. And so at the birthday party, Salome, her daughter, danced. It's probably a good thing that Matthew didn't go into any detail about the nature of the dance. But she danced. And so Herod does something that very, very foolish to do. He made a rash vow. Make any request you want to, up to half the kingdom, it's yours. So she goes and asks Mama. Mama saw this as her way of shutting John the Baptist up. She said, I want John's head on a platter. I want him decapitated. And this girl, how old she was, did it, and then anyway, that's the rest of that story. This again is something about the character of these people, but I did want to say that about the nature of their marriage relationship, that they had no right to be in it. And it could be today that you run across situations like that. And it's not something that I enjoy at all. And that's one of the reasons that, well, I'm not going to pursue that one any further. I don't like to talk about divorce and remarriage. Okay. All right. So after John dies, in verse 13 of chapter 14, when Jesus heard of it, that is, when he heard John's disciples buried John, then they went and told Jesus. We're not told what the reaction of Jesus was. We do know that they were close. We know what Jesus' evaluation was of John. Among those that are born of women, what? What about John? Yeah, that's right. Nobody compared to John. And they were cousins, some second cousins or something. They were cousins. So there was a, if there's not only a kinship of blood between them, there was a kinship of spirit between John and Jesus. To put it mildly, Jesus thought highly of John. And now he has been put to what had to have been a horrible death, the severing of his head. And so they go and tell Jesus. And in verse 13, when Jesus heard of it, he departed thence by ship into a desert place apart. Immediately, when Jesus heard that John had been killed and was now buried, the thing that Jesus did was what? He went back to work. There was nothing he could do for John, obviously. But there were things that Jesus could do for other people. And the greatest thing that he could do was teach them. And right underneath that, the next greatest thing that that Jesus could do was to heal people. Not so much, and I don't want to be misunderstood here, not so much to cure them of their physical problems. That was a part, and Jesus was moved by that. But I have all ideas, just from other things that we've read, that one of the reasons that Jesus was going to go right back to work after John's death was that he could perform miracles of healing, a lot of that was. And these miracles of healing would cause those who heard him to reach perhaps the proper conclusion about the nature of Jesus and turn their lives over to Jesus. That was, again, this is speculation. But I think that was probably why. And I'm not trying to take away from the fact that that Jesus grieved over John's death. We know that he grieved over the death of Lazarus. But the thing that was uppermost in Jesus' mind was working his work, do the work that God sent him to do. All right. So when Jesus heard of it, he departed thence by ship into a deserted place or a desert place apart. And when the people had heard thereof, they followed him on foot out of the cities. Now, a lot of times when I read a lot of these stories, my mind kind of wanders. And I try to read things into the text, which is not always a smart thing to do. But here is this ship, and evidently it was sailing close enough to the shore that the people could see it. And they walked along the shore to keep up with the speed of the ship. Wherever Jesus was going, that's where they wanted to go. For whatever reason, some of it was probably to be healed of their particular physical ailments. But they wanted to follow Jesus, and so they followed him on foot out of the cities. Now, and again, I'm trying to think about what all that would have involved. I'm sure they had to put some effort into that. They were on foot, obviously, and they had to walk along ground. Now, I don't know how uneven it was, how treacherous it was, how dangerous it may have been in some boggy, low-lying places. But that was the determination of these people. So they followed on foot out of the cities, and Jesus went forth and saw a great multitude and was moved with compassion toward them, and he healed their sick. So I don't know where Jesus was, the text doesn't tell us. When John's disciples found him, or his disciples found him, or John's, we don't know where Jesus was on land, but Jesus, from wherever he was, when he was told about the death of John, he goes. And they followed him on foot out of the cities. And Jesus went forth and saw a great multitude and moved with compassion toward them, and he healed the sick. And when it was evening, verse 15, his disciples came to him saying, "This is a desert place or a deserted place, and the time is now past. Send the multitude away that they may go into the villages and buy themselves food." What? Does something appear to you as strange when the disciples told Jesus, get rid of these people? They're probably hungry, and we have no food. And so they can go into the city and buy their food. Is there something wrong with that?
They're putting the priority on the wrong thing. They were getting spiritual food. That's what was more important. You can go for a little while without physical food if you need to.
Okay. All right, that's one thing. You didn't hear Mark. They were putting the stress on the wrong thing. To them, food was the most important thing. And that, remember now, these were disciples of Jesus, and perhaps some of John's mixed in. And their priorities were mixed up. As Mark said, you know, you can go a while without food. And evidently, again, we're not told this, but evidently that was not as much of a concern of these disciples as it was to Jesus' disciples. You know, they were looking at the situation from their eyes, not eyes of the multitude. And Jesus saw the great multitude and was moved with compassion toward them and healed the sick. There's something else that strikes me as interesting here. Here was a need, a bodily need, as the disciples saw it, a need for food. And their solution to that problem, they assumed that they were hungry. The solution to that problem was to send the multitudes away to get food. Up until now, had the disciples ever seen Jesus provide for a similar need? Jesus took money out of his pocket and said, "Go into town, go to the store and get food." True or false?
Converted water to wine at a feast when they ran out. That was a consumable.
Jesus didn't run down to the store and get more wine, did he? He took care of it. You think as long, and this, by the way, Matthew 14 is about, is the midway through the book of Matthew. And it's also more or less midway through ministry of Jesus. So, and if his ministry was about 3 years, then they'd been with him for a year and a half. Had they seen the same miracles that everybody else saw? Up close and personal. You'd like to think that they would have started putting something together, say, "Lord, we've seen what you can do in providing for physical needs. Why not take care of their need yourself?" They don't have to go into town. You can handle that. But that's not what they did, obviously. So Jesus, verse 16, said to them, they need not depart. Give ye them something to eat. The disciples still don't get it. They still don't get it. They said unto him, making excuses, they said unto him, we have here but five loaves and two fish. What can we do? We've just got five loaves of bread and two fish. It still has not penetrated their brain what Jesus is trying to get them to see. So Jesus, in verse 18, he said, bring them, the loaves and fishes, bring them hither to me. And he commanded the multitude to sit down on the grass, and he took the five loaves and the two fish, and looking up to heaven, he blessed and brake and gave the loaves to his disciples and the disciples to the multitude. And they did all eat and were filled, and they took up the fragments that remained, 12 baskets full. And they that had eaten were about 5,000 people. Is that how that reads? What does it say? 5,000 men. So you'd like to think that there were probably around 10,000 people on that occasion. That's the size of a fairly good sized town today. Go through a town. Population, 10,000. Pretty good size. Now remember, that big of a crowd had been following Jesus for I don't know how long. And Jesus fed them and had food left over. This, I don't know what the reaction of the apostles was. I don't know if they ever apologized to Jesus and said, oh, I'm sorry, we should have seen this. I don't know what they did. But anyway, okay, we're out of town. 5 minutes? 3 minutes? Okay. Oh, you're raising your hand. I thought you were giving me a time.
You got three, and then we'll tell you. It reminds me of John 21, where after the resurrection of Jesus, the apostles are out in the boat, and Jesus tells them to cast the net on the other side. They drag it ashore, and they approach Jesus, and he is cooking them fish for breakfast, and he tells them to come and eat. So he never disconnected from the human element.
Yeah.
Of what people needed.
Yeah, I'd like to think that I would not have made this mistake. And that's a mistake we make when we read the scriptures a lot. Well, I wouldn't have, or I would have. Really? Really? Anyway, we're out of time. And great chapter 14. Really a lot of good information here. Any questions? Any final questions? All right, thank you.